WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Englehart, and you're listening to From a Woman's Point of View.
Wow.
Did you miss your favorite show? You know, if you miss our show or if you miss another show, any special program on WMNF, you can go to demand listening through the WMNF archives at WMNF.org or with the WMNF app.
Well, things just keep coming. I'm hoping you just have it tuned to WMNF all day. Amy Goodman, as usual, is absolutely outstanding. And it was very troubling to hear, you know, chemicals getting in the Ohio water. I mean, you know, it seems that environmentally I have fought chemicals all of my life. And we've made, frankly, very little progress in the sense of demanding their safety, precautionary principles, proving certain things are looked at before they're used ubiquitously, but haven't gotten very far with that. And to tell you the truth, I really feel with all the dangers that we have had chemically in our environment with toxins and all the many diseases they cause, it's nothing to me compared to the dangers we have absolutely cascading on us right now with EMF fields and all of our absolute fascination with everything smart, whether it's a smart television, smart refrigerator, smart meters, and 4 or 5G. And really that if chemicals were bad enough, I mean, in the sense you did have some opportunities perhaps to break them down, you could try and avoid them, you could try and not use them, but there is no way you will be able to avoid the plethora of the assault of 24/7 of frequency fields in the EMF spectrum, of which we know very little about, a little bit about ionizing and thermal, a little bit about infrared, but nothing about the other aspects of the EMF fields that will be bombarding your body 24/7. So that is the way that the energy companies are essentially are going to keep their hand in the trillion-dollar pot of energy. And so it is scandalous, and there's just not enough attention being paid for it, and we are paying dearly. But, you know, I'm watching the fires. I don't know how the people in Australia are standing it. I'm also thinking about the farmers that their fields have been flooded and frozen since last March. And here in this country, and, you know, we know climate change. Greta Thunberg tried her best when in Davos to warn people. And, of course, we're watching impeachment. And it seems that the chickens are coming home to roost, people. And, you know, that I'm hoping nature or God or whoever you want to put in this whole creation, so to speak, if you see it as a singular event, you hope that they still want to give us some second and third or 2,000 or 3,000 chances. Because we are in dire, dire trouble of not taking responsibility. It's just simple, common sense things. If you have a waste, you can't just dump it anywhere, into the water, into the ground, into the air. If you've got a chemical, hey, this is really valuable because it's flexible, it does this, this, or that, and you prove it's dangerous. You have the bodies line up, and then you say why it's dangerous. It's up to you to prove it, not for them to prove that it's safe before they introduce it into the market. You know, I mean, what can I say? But anyway, I am excited about this show, and I can only hope you're watching the impeachment proceedings. It's kind of amazing, but I thought Adam Schiff last night was absolutely brilliant in his summation, and I was so moved when he said that there we had, you know, civil servants who came forward even though they were under, you know, they were told not to testify, but they did. They did not ignore the subpoena. They did not ignore the orders of courts in this country, and they've tried to fulfill their obligation to the Constitution and the people of this country and not the president they serve, and they testified when he said, you know, they risk their jobs and their careers. And looking at the senators, are you willing to be honest and perhaps do the same? And so what can I say? Our democracy is on the line. Our Constitution is on the line. Our environment is losing, and so we have so much work to do. And I can only hope that somewhere, somehow, there is the time, because I really find the young people get it, and a lot of other people get it too. It's not just the young people, but they're between the rock and the hard place. And I can only hope that they have a chance to express their brilliance and their creativity and their love and joy and hopes for life, and hope that that will sustain it, because frankly, I think all of us older, it's happened on our watch. I mean, it didn't start on our watch, but we cannot look at these scenes and not feel a terrible sense of failure and lack of responsibility, lack of respect for life. And we have the fight of our lives in our hands, and we have to actually dig down deep and find resources we never knew we had. And I can only hope we do have them to finally get engaged and do the things that we can do, at least to reverse climate change. You know, I mean, we won't reverse it. We're not going to return it. Denali is not going to ever return to the Denali that people have known for hundreds of years. Florida is not going to return to the way it was 100 years, but perhaps we can make it viable for life. That's what we're working on. And I'm like Theta, Greta Thunberg, that, you know, it really is upsetting, because we don't need to invent the wheel. We don't need to invent the technology. We need to invent the will. We need to invent the backbone to actually change things, and change things substantially. But look at it as a war. It's just a very subtle war. And you don't know you've been attacked, and not only you've been attacked, but they are occupying your area, and you have to fight hard to try and gain it back. But anyway, enough. So Arlene, you go ahead while I get this music on, because I really am excited about the show, and we're going to call very shortly our first guest.
looking forward to that. And of course, yesterday was the 47th anniversary of Roe v. Indeed. Wade. And so Mary will be talking to Jessica Mason Piclo about where we stand now. In fact, they actually talked yesterday, so it was right on the anniversary. And unfortunately, I don't think it's a terribly happy anniversary.
Oh, hey, you know, we're fighting. We have been fighting. And it's kind of sad, but we will keep fighting, because let's face it, it's our bodies, our lives at stake. And if we aren't going to fight for it, it doesn't seem that anybody else is. They're going to take it away. And so, you know, it's a fight we can win. And I think we will. And also, you know, we're going to leave it up to you and the rest of the news and the public affairs to be dealing more with the impeachment that's happening. We're hoping you're going to be watching it. So today on the show, we aren't going to be covering that. But there's an event happening next Thursday at USF that I think you really might be very interested in, and I hope you can fit time in your busy schedule. And for you students listening out there, I hope you really can fit time in to go to the Marshall Center, because I think there's something that really will be of interest to an awful lot of people. Courting Gender Justice, Russia, Turkey, and the European Court of Human Rights. And just in a very few moments, I'll be calling Valerie Sperling, and she and her colleague Lisa Sundstrom have written just an extraordinary book, Courting Gender Justice. And so, and then as Arlene said, Jessica Mason Piclo. So we're going to be trying in there, people. And so in the meantime, I'm going to put this on by Amy DiNio. She's talking about the amendment. And so then we'll come back with Valerie Sperling. Well, that doesn't seem to want to do it. I don't quite know why that didn't go, but I just hope it's going now. We'll be coming back with Valerie Sperling.
Wouldn't it be nice if we had an amendment to give civil rights to women, to once and for all just really lay it down from the point of view of women? I know what you're thinking, that's just redundant. Chicks got it good now, they can almost be president. But it's worker against worker, time and time again. again, cause the rich use certain issues as a tool. When I say we need the ERA, it ain't cause I'm a fool. It's cause without it, nobody can get away with anything cool. And you don't have to go far, like just over to Canada, to feel a heightened sense of live and let live. What is it about Americans?
Well, I am going to pod this music down because with us on the phone, I'm so glad we have our first guest. And we have Valerie Sperling on with us on the line. And she is a professor of political science at Clark University. She's the author of Sex, Politics, and Putin. That's interesting. Is he on his horse, Dr. Sperling? Legitimacy in Russia, Political Legitimacy in Russia, Altered States, the Globalization of Accountability, and Organizing Women in Contemporary Russia. And as I said, there's an extraordinary event happening at USF next Thursday, 12:30 to 1:45 p.m. It's going to be in the Marshall Student Center here at USF Tampa, room 3707. And I think Dr. Sperling, you and your colleague, Dr. Sumstrom, are going to be really involved in some very interesting things. So welcome so much to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm going to pod you up a little bit so we can hear you just a little bit better. And so, obviously, you have quite a fascination with Russia. And why is that?
Oh, I became interested in Russia when I was an undergraduate. And that was back in the bad old days of the Soviet Union, when we had the arms race. And I wanted to grow up to be an arms control negotiator. So that's how, because I thought, you know, perhaps that would help end the Cold War. And that's why I started studying Russia way back then.
You know, that's interesting because I found actually that I was always kind of sympathetic to the people of Russia. I thought they were pretty extraordinary. And I kind of felt sorry for them that they put all that time under czars. And then in the remarkably short time, frankly, under communism, that they modernized at great personal human rights expenses. But I always kind of, and then with Gorbachev, I've kind of always think that the American people and the Russian people have a lot in common, really, that it's almost to me been too bad that discard the leaders like Stalin, Trotsky, Putin, that actually we have an awful lot in common.
I think that's true in many ways. You know, we've got in both cases a highly educated population. We've got a highly multi-ethnic population. I see what you mean. I think that the populations have a lot in common. The governments maybe increasingly right now also have a lot in common. But
unfortunately, that's only too true. And also, I really found, and I must admit, I did not get the book in time to really read it very thoroughly, but I really very cursorily went through it. And I really found it fascinating and troubling because in many ways, they are far more backward, if you will. And I guess somehow I thought under communism that there was more of equality. I thought women could do a lot more jobs and, had opportunities. And I was really sad to see that, frankly, they have met many of the very same problems that we do here without the kind of infrastructure of organizations that we have in this country. I didn't realize that it was so important that we have those organizations that we've had to actually help us along the way.
Yes. So the book is about gender discrimination and gender discrimination court cases in Russia and also in Turkey. But yes, one of the things that you see is the different kinds of gender discrimination that women encounter in Russia. And I think the comparison you're making is that in the United States, we have a pretty strong, pretty long-lasting feminist movement that's helped to raise issues like, for example, domestic violence in the United States for a long time. You know, we had our first domestic violence shelters opened, you know, our battered women's shelters opened in the United States in the 1970s. For Russia, because of the Soviet dictatorship and the Communist Party being in power for so long, they didn't have their first battered women's shelters until the 1990s. And again, because, you know, the communist leadership was really opposed to the population organizing under any banner other than state-approved communism, you didn't have a strong feminist movement to put some of these issues forward, like sexual harassment or domestic violence or even marital rape. So we do benefit in the U.S. from having these strong national level and also grassroots local women's organizations to help put forward these issues. They do have some organizations like that in Russia, local feminist organizations. But one of the things we found in the book is that feminist groups don't tend to have the legal training to be able to bring gender discrimination cases into court. It's mostly the human rights groups that have, I guess, with some exceptions, been less interested in women's rights. It's mostly those human rights groups that have the training to be able to bring cases into the Russian courts or to the European Court of Human Rights, which is kind of the substance of the book.
You know, that was another aspect of your book that I really found fascinating. The distinction, which I hadn't really thought that much about before, between rights and victims and the difference in the training, because the legalities have just been so integral to so much of our work, the work that's being done here. And I, among many other things, I was horrified to realize that a big, huge difference in Russia is that the women, if they represent them, will need to represent themselves in court because they're, I don't know whether that's how it's set up structurally, but there aren't the lawyers that know anything about sex discrimination or violence against women. And that alone would be such a burden. I can't imagine a woman having to prepare and present her own legal case here.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting point. What you're referring to is that. So what you're talking about is private prosecution, which is what comes up in many instances of domestic violence. So just one thing to point out is that a couple of years ago, in 2017, first-time battery in any given calendar year was decriminalized. So a husband could beat up his wife once a year as long as there weren't serious lasting physical injuries, and it was no longer a crime. It became an administrative offense, so it could be punished, you know, with a fine or with some community service. But setting that aside, right, if you have a case of domestic violence in Russia with light bodily injury, so that is, there's some lasting injury, that falls under the category of private prosecution. So what does that mean? That means that the woman, the victim, is responsible for gathering the evidence, for bringing it to court, to interviewing the witnesses, to making the case before the judge, and if they miss any of these, court hearings, which are usually more than, one, that sort of just throws the case out. And so you can imagine that under those conditions, it's very rare that a woman would be, or a man, or anybody would be, who isn't a lawyer, would be able to manage that process successfully. So it's sort of no wonder that, of under private prosecution, something like only 37% of the time do they actually get, all the way through to the end of the case and a sentence, whereas when you're talking about a state prosecution, it's more like 72% of the time.
And, something that's a totally new phenomenon to me. I mean, I was aware of the European Court of Human Rights, and, but I haven't followed it at all closely. But I did not realize it was such a factor, not only in Russia, but in all of Europe. Tell me, how would you compare it? Because the United States isn't part of that. But how would you compare the European Court of Human Rights, say, to our courts here, protecting human rights? And I was interested that so very few Russian cases, I wouldn't have thought of Russia almost allowing their people to go to that, you know, because it might be a bad mark on them. But the very few cases they've had, it's been men from Russia that have won their cases of discrimination. And so could you go through some of that? Because I think for most of us, we don't know very much about the European Court of Human Rights.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So the European Court of Human Rights is narrower, say, than the U.S. court system, because the European Court of Human Rights only takes cases that have to do with violations of the European Convention on Human Rights. So what is the convention? The convention covers rights like your right to life, not meaning the protection of the fetus, but meaning your right not to have the state take your life away. And if your life is taken away, the state is obligated to do a thorough investigation. Rights like physical integrity rights, the right not to be tortured, equal rights to education, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. And there is this additional Article 14, which is on discrimination, and it covers your right not to be discriminated against on the basis of sex, race, national origin, political perspective, religion, and other. So other covers a lot of territory. The thing about that article is it can't be used by itself. It has to be used in conjunction with one of the other rights. So in other words, if, let's say, the Russian state outlaws a gay rights protest, that would be a violation of the article that covers freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, plus Article 14, discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Okay? So that's what the European Court of Human Rights does. It takes cases from individuals in countries in the Council of Europe, which is bigger than the EU, right? The EU is kind of Western Europe. The Council of Europe is the EU countries plus almost all of what used to be the former communist countries, plus Turkey. So citizens from Russia, starting in 1998, when Russia signed off on that European Convention on Human Rights, could bring cases to the European Court of Human Rights. And what you're referring to and what drove our interest in this book was the fact that the first four cases on gender discrimination that came from Russia to and through the European Court of Human Rights all came from men complaining that their rights had been violated, their rights as men had been violated. So we found that, Lisa and I found that really interesting, and we decided to pursue it a little bit more. And it really was not until last year, it was not until last July that the first gender discrimination case brought by a woman from Russia to the European Court of Human Rights got a positive judgment, and that was the Volodina case. And this was a case of domestic violence. So the first case that came through from Russia from a woman on gender discrimination, the court found in her favor. And what had happened was this woman was beaten by her ex-boyfriend, repeatedly. He cut the brake lines in her car. He kidnapped her. He assaulted her on multiple occasions. She went to the police no less than seven times, and they kept refusing to open a case, saying, oh, this isn't serious enough. Oh, he punched you only once, and one punch isn't enough, to qualify, for a case to be open. And so she brought this case to the European Court of Human Rights, which found in her favor and said, you know what? The Russian state is failing to protect you. And it's doing that in a discriminatory way, because if you were a man and somebody had, kidnapped you and beaten you up multiple times and cut the brake lines to your car, in other words, if this was not a domestic violence situation, the police absolutely would have taken action. So that was the first case that came from a woman in Russia on gender discrimination, and it was supported by the court. But before that, the first four cases had come from men, and only one of them got a positive judgment at the court. Konstantin Markin versus Russia. He was in the Russian military, and he had three children, and he and his wife divorced, and he wanted custody of the children, which he could have, but he also wanted this parental leave in order to take care of them. And the Russian courts denied him that opportunity, which is open to women in the military. And so the European Court of Human Rights found in his favor. So that was the first. That was the first case from a man. The second one was these two men who had been condemned to life in prison, which is something that women can't be sentenced to in Russia. And so they again complained that their rights were being violated because they, you know, were being given this sentence that women couldn't get, that they were being punished or discriminated against because they were men. The European Court of Human Rights did not find in their favor because states get some latitude on things like protecting women and protecting women's reproductive rights and women's motherhood and things like that, that the court felt didn't really necessitate women having to get, you know, life in prison to make them equal to make them equal to men. And then the other two cases that came from men complaining about discrimination in Russia were both basically custody cases where men in a relationship, so where a marriage broke down, the man wanted custody of the child, the court in Russia gave custody of the child to the mother, and the men objected, saying the only reason that the women were given custody of the children was because of gender stereotypes, saying that children should, you know, small children should be with the mother.
Well, this gives you an idea of how fascinating this is going to be, and I will leave it for somebody in the audience to ask you about, particularly when how this relates particularly to the United States. I mean, there are an awful lot of similarities, but I was particularly fascinated in the Baltimore area when they were studying about police handling of victims with the Freddie Gay case, what they found out about the treatment of women, so many, particularly African-American women, and I will leave that as a tantalizer to be discussed next Thursday, January 30th, that Dr. Sperling and her colleague, Dr. Lisa Sundstrom, who along with Maliki Sayoglu, wrote this book, Courting Gender Justice, Russia, Turkey, and the European Court of Human Rights. And it's going to be again 12:30 to 1:45, room 3707, the Marshall Student Center. So, Dr. Sperling, thank you so much for giving us this time. And this is really a very provocative and extraordinary book. I wish we had more time to give to it today. And thank you so much, and you do take care.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. Arlene, did you want to say something?
Well, I just think that if you tune in next Thursday to Radioactivity.
Oh, right. Rob is going to have them in live, I believe, actually, in the studio. So that should be really, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating book. And so, you know, I'm looking at the time, and I'm just not going to do a musical interlude. I am going to go right straight to the next interview. Yesterday was the 47th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. I was able to catch up with Jessica Mason Pico, and let's hear what she has to say. So happy to welcome back our attorney, our lawyer extraordinaire, who we really need to talk to, actually on this day that I'm talking to her, on the 47th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. And yes, I'm talking about Jessica Mason Piccolo, and she is a legal correspondent and vice president for courts and law at Rewire.news, that extraordinary website that just has this phenomenal information, and frankly, not only about women. So Jessica Mason Piccolo, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's always such a pleasure.
Well, in between impeachment and worrying about wars, indeed, this is the anniversary. And so there is an awful lot on the agenda, but, you know, we've been dodging bullets now, it seems to me, for years, about particularly it's a time to review Roe versus Wade and some of the problems we have in this country right now, the year 2020. So, Jessica, what are you most particularly watching?
Well, obviously, you know, we have a Supreme Court case in a couple months that will give us a very clear picture of just how much, if at all, the conservative members of the Supreme Court respect abortion rights and jurisprudence. So that is a big issue. That's June Medical Services versus Gee, and that is a case that looks identical to one that you and I have spent many, many hours on this show talking about out of Texas, where providers were required to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. I am also keeping an eye on the increasingly extreme attacks on abortion rights at the state levels. These bans that we saw last year, the, you know, 6-week bans, the total abortion bans, we're going to see more of those because lawmakers still feel emboldened. They still feel as though they have a political minority that is powerful enough to push these agenda items through. And also now that they have successfully captured the federal courts to such a degree that they can start to get decisions on in their favor. And so that's extremely troubling. And then finally, I am keeping an eye on and continue to keep an eye on the rhetoric around abortion restrictions and abortion access. We hear conservatives using increasingly hostile rhetoric. You know, President Trump is talking about things like Democrats supporting abortion after birth and abortion up to the moment of birth. Not only are those lies, they're lies with a very specific political agenda, which is to make it too chilling, too scary, too threatening to be an abortion provider and to be an abortion patient. And we see the very real and very deadly consequences of that rhetoric as threats against providers and patients continue to tick up year after year.
Well, you know, Jessica, I am learning more about law, perhaps, than I wanted to learn by doing this show. And so I'm going to go back where you started, June Medical Services versus G. And now this has been Louisiana kicking around since Jindal, right? I mean, and then in Texas, essentially the similar case because they were demanding that the doctors who perform abortion have to have admitting privileges. But for very good reasons, actually, this hasn't been a requirement. Number one, there are very few medical problems that arise that they need to have a hospital admitting, but also there are ideological reasons and personal reasons, and so this just hasn't been a factor. But I think also a very important part of that is that they are challenging the right of providers to have any standing in the case, and they are the ones that are going to be first criminally charged, so what do they need to have standing, I might ask?
Right. Well, so you bring up a very important point, which is the standing issue. And the state of Louisiana is not arguing that providers don't have the ability to challenge restrictions on their own behalf, right? So if a provider is facing criminal prosecution for violating abortion restriction, then yes, they would have standing to challenge that. But what they are saying is that they wouldn't have standing to challenge those restrictions on behalf of their patients, which is a really important legal concept called third-party standing. And it's also a very cynical argument for the anti-choice community to make, and here's why. Third-party standing is a really routine legal doctrine, and in abortion rights cases, the courts have recognized it for almost as long as they've recognized abortion rights, so nearly 50 years. And what it says is that in some instances, third parties, in this case abortion providers, can go ahead and make constitutional claims on behalf of other people because their interests are similar enough that it makes sense. It saves resources for all of the parties involved. The court isn't hearing the same type of case, brought by individual plaintiff after individual plaintiff. There's an efficiency argument to it. And this has been the rule of the law, or the rule of the land, as long as, you know, like I said, Roe versus Wade was recognized, more or less. But this principle will be revisited because anti-choice activists have argued that when it comes to abortion restrictions that lawmakers pass because they are claiming to advance the interests of patient health and safety, that abortion providers have a conflict of interest there because what they do is provide a service for money. And so therefore, they have a financial incentive not to do that safely. It's ridiculous when you actually say the argument out loud because in no other context do we attack the veracity and the ethics of the medical profession the way that we do in the context of providing comprehensive reproductive health care. Only in those instances are doctors unethical and immoral and operating from a purely greed and violence standpoint. And it's really the anti-choice community needs to be called out about that.
Well, so do some Supreme Court justices. I still hear a little ring in my ears that it doesn't matter if they get the science wrong. As long as they believe the science is right, that's good enough. And I don't know how you answer that. You know, I mean, but you know, Jessica, it's and there, Texas, we thought decided that and whole woman's health.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, just keep coming back, just keep hammering, because as you say, unfortunately, what, one out of four federal judges now have been appointed by Trump and essentially Leonard Leo. That we know that they definitely come from an ideological perspective. And the same thing, actually, we're looking at terminology all over the place. And so it's always been a battle, so to speak, challenging the ethics, challenging the morality, if you will, or the intelligence of the woman. And so any which way they can, and they keep coming. And so, and to the point now that they're saying, hey, this is all about Roe versus Wade. You know it, we know it, so let's get to the chase and let's go right after it. And tell me, in some of the cases, particularly about viability, which is really the basis of Roe, if you will, you know that there's a certain point with viability, and before that, you know, a woman has a total right. But this is also being challenged by other states that are saying 6 weeks, 18 weeks, 12 weeks, and yet it's kind of in your face, but no one's actually saying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, now they're saying it. You know, now we're actually hearing lawmakers in places like Alabama, Missouri say, we know that that this is a law that the courts would typically consider unconstitutional, but we don't care because we want to challenge that precedent. We want this to go directly there. So they're saying the quiet parts out loud now.
And tell me, wasn't there a case actually that came to the Supreme Court and that since Kavanaugh's been on the bench, that rather than deciding it and saying, no, you know, that's pre-viability, they threw it back to the appellate court? Or am I crazy on that?
No, you're correct. So what you're thinking of is the case out of Indiana that had several restrictions. Among them was you could be thinking of two things because there have been two. I am assuming it's the Indiana case because that would be a pre-viability ban. That involved the state's ban on abortions, what we call reason bans. That's an abortion based on the sex, race, or Down's diagnosis of the fetus. And the Seventh Circuit had said that that was unconstitutional and blocked that. And the Supreme Court didn't weigh in on that yet, but it gave, so it let that ruling stand. But in doing so, Justice Thomas wrote a really bizarre opinion that said basically we didn't have any choice but to rule this way. However, we still really don't like these bans. And that's been a green light for states to, as we're starting to see, as state legislatures come back into session, to pass more of those. Because, a ban like a reason, you know, a violate, you know, saying that you can't have an abortion based on a particular reason constitutes a pre-viability abortion ban. The courts also upheld a pre-viability abortion ban many, many years ago in Gonzalez versus Carhart when they upheld the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Act.
So you're really getting down into the nitty gritty. And also I'm going to go back and, you know, that not only in June medical services, and I think what hasn't the Supreme Court going to hear cases in March or hear the hearings in March and then perhaps make a decision as early as June. But then, as you say, we've got all these cases stacked up, and not the least of which is Texas. You know, Texas and the fetal remains, and that this is obligated. And then you've got Utah and other states. And so it's almost like there's a dam waiting to break, and it kind of starts with that June medical services, right?
Yeah, it will. We'll see the impact of June medical services ripple out immediately, regardless of how the court rules, in part because we have these cases that you mentioned in the federal circuit courts of appeals that are just simply waiting for the justices to make up their mind, depending on how the Supreme Court rules in June medical services. But also because lawmakers are looking to the signals that the court sends in that opinion for future signposts as to how far they can go in restricting abortion access.
Well, and we've been pretty used to, attacks on various procedures. And what you talked about language before. Well, when you get into languages and when you hear D&E and stuff like this, you can really get into some pretty grotesque, descriptions. And not the least of which, saying that medical abortion can be reversed. Once again, science, don't worry about that. That's irrelevant. But also, this is really important because once again, the language barrier not only implicates the woman's character, but her intelligence, if you will.
Yeah, and we, you know, we have anti-choice advocates have an entire line of restrictions based entirely on insulting the intelligence of abortion patients, and it's their plays on the concept of informed consent. I mean, there's no reason to mandate a vaginal ultrasound prior to a medication abortion, but yet lawmakers in states like Kentucky have, and the Supreme Court has said that okay, and they've said that that is necessary because the patient going into the procedure hasn't sufficiently thought about the implication of what they're about to do. And that right there is absolutely insulting to someone's intelligence.
And once again, we're talking to Jessica Mason Piccolo, and she is Vice President of Law and Courts for that terrific website, rewire.news. And if you want far more additional information than we're giving you, I strongly suggest you go there. And if you say, Mary, we've heard all this before, and you're right, and unfortunately, you will keep hearing it unless we make some changes, because also they keep adding to the agenda. And so now a very important part is the reasons for. And so if a woman has a disabled, for whatever reason, that's going to be barred because of sex, because of race, or because of physical abilities, or any diagnosis of disability. And this also now has become a huge challenge to women to face.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as these abortion restrictions come up one by one, for somebody who does not pay attention to this particular area of law and politics very religiously, you know, or who's maybe in, like, considers themselves pro-choice personally, or, you know, maybe has some squishiness around there, these kinds of restrictions sound reasonable. But when you stack them all up together, we have situations in states like Missouri where you have one abortion provider and a really limited window for which patients can access services. And even within that limited window, a whole host of hurdles that they also have to cross.
Yeah, and you have, what, states like Mississippi that have one provider for over 1 million women?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we talk about the legacy of Roe versus Wade, I think it's important just to put it in terms of a promise. You know, Roe says that abortion is a fundamental right and that the state has limited power to restrict it. And for many people in this country, that has just only been a promise. It still remains immediately out of reach, whether it's because of where they live geographically in a state that's hostile to access, and so there is this limited window that we've been talking about, whether they are of low-income means, and so therefore we're relying on Medicaid, and Medicaid does not provide, except in very rare circumstances in some states, funding for abortion, or, you know, whether it's because of a whole host of other reasons that stack up on top of that, that for the most part has meant that abortion access in this country remains the province of affluent white women.
Yeah, and then challenging Title X and being very happy that Planned Parenthood has pretty much gotten out of it. And that, you know, I strongly suggest to the listeners that you listen to Jessica and her great and good colleague, Imani Gandhi, and their podcast, Boom, Lawyered. They get right down into the nitty-gritty of it. But I had no idea. I mean, I knew it had to be bad because I know how much Planned Parenthood really is the main provider for so many young women, particularly in this country. I had no idea that it had so cut the services to that degree, and somehow trying to suggest that it really hasn't had much effect at all.
Yeah, that's absurd to say that it hasn't had that much effect at all. Planned Parenthood is the country's largest reproductive health care services provider in the country. And to put this in context for your listeners, just as to how far the pendulum has swung for conservatives when it comes to Title X and Planned Parenthood and fully funding family planning services, George W. Bush's grandfather, George H. Prescott Bush, was a board of directors member for Planned Parenthood. The Bush family was a supporter, as were so many conservatives, of Planned Parenthood because they saw it as the logical answer to their quest to reduce abortion rates, which was to advance contraception. And now we have conservatives saying that they're not just anti-abortion, they're anti-contraception as well, which means that they are pro-state mandated birth.
Yeah, in fact, wasn't HW nicknamed Rubbers? I mean,
yeah, he was. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's, there's this lovely, what, you know, should be the kind of thing that brings people together on this issue of choice and state power. And instead, what we have, as conservatives have gone completely off the rails.
And tell me, Jessica, I know that Representative Chu and I think Blumenthal have suggested, and they're working for the Women's Health Protection Act. And what do you think the chances are of that? And particularly, I'm looking at Mitch McConnell, and yeah. So I'd say zero and less, but at least that gives a little hope, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's wonderful that Democrats have really zeroed in on reproductive rights, access, and justice as a critical part of the Democratic platform. It absolutely is. It's a question of fundamental human rights. That's not the same as what are they going to be able to do about it in Congress, which is the point that you bring up. So I think things like the Reproductive Health Act, codifying Roe versus Wade, these are all excellent starts. We are going to have to remove from office Mitch McConnell because nothing will get through the Senate with him in its leadership. You know, I'm not saying that that means that Republicans writ large wouldn't be able to be workable on this. You know, I do think that there is the possibility of culture change within it. I do think that there are conservatives who do not like the direction in such an extreme degree to which the party has gone on reproductive rights. So I remain hopeful that there are some reasonable heads within that space to have conversations and work together for solutions with. However, none of that is happening with Mitch McConnell, I believe.
And so tell me, Jessica, do you think that there literally is going to be a direct in-your-face challenge of Roe versus Wade this
yes.
year?
Oh, this year, I don't know. I mean, you know, we're seeing folks try to make those kinds of arguments in the Student Medical Services versus Zeke case. But we are seeing in the appellate courts, in those cases where states have passed blatantly unconstitutional pre-viability abortion bans. So abortion bans that ban abortion at 15 weeks, at 6 weeks, for example, at 8 weeks. Those are direct challenges to Roe. So it is only a matter of time before one of them finds their way to the Supreme Court. And we could see a petition on one of those cases as soon, you know, get filed with the court as soon as next spring, and the court consider taking it up for the following fall. Will it? I don't know. I think John Roberts maybe wants those cases to sort of bake a little bit longer at the lower court level, but it's not a question of if. It is absolutely a question of when.
And this is an election year. And
yes.
And this is kind of an adjunct, but I didn't get to listen to your boom lawyer. Leonard Leo is stepping down. I mean, when we're talking to judges, we're talking to Federalist Society, we're talking to mm-hmm. Leonard Leo. And he is stepping down from that role, but he's taking on a new and bigger role. So real quickly, what is his new plan of attack?
Yeah, so stepping down is a little bit of a misnomer. He's sort of stepping aside. Leonard Leo will still be, the puppet master of the strings of the Federalist Society, but he's taking the Federalist Society and effectively putting it up on steroids and weaponizing it even more in a new dark money group that is its sole purpose is to create attack ads in areas where conservatives are having difficult elections and to rally for their causes and their people. And he said that the first cause that they are going to rally for is a $10 million ad buy supporting Trump judicial nominees going into November.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the appropriate response.
Well, I mean, I'm still figuring out what can be done to redress the terrible disbalance that we've had, because these are lifetime appointments. So we're not looking at... Yeah, I mean, in other words, all of our children, our grandchildren are going to suffer with, frankly, an awful lot of them are either unqualified or extreme ideologues, and these are not the kind of people you want on a federal court position. So we're already trying to figure out, and what do you think we can do to kind of redress this terrible transgression?
Well, the good thing about the federal courts is that their structure is a creature of statute. And what I mean by that is that Congress has the power to alter it. So it's really exciting to hear Democrats start to talk about solutions to conservatives stacking the federal courts as they have. One of those solutions is expanding the number of justices on the Supreme Court. Another is expanding the number of justices at the federal courts of appeal and district court level. And frankly, these arguments make good sense regardless of the partisanship behind them. The federal courts have been starved for resources for decades. It takes forever to hear a case, for example. You file a complaint in federal court, and it will be 3 years sometimes before you have a trial date. And that's just a function of a democracy not working because Congress has not put as a priority funding staff and for the courts at a robust level. When we're talking about judges, we're talking about staff for the federal courts. Congress could expand the number of judicial districts. That is one way that it could go.
And for other reasons to expand the congressional districts, we might increase the number in the House of Representatives. And this would be good because you'd actually have more representatives representing fewer people. So perhaps they'd have better contact with their people, which would be better for everyone. But I'm going to go back with that because, you know, I'm really kind of concerned because one of the things I've always really respected about the courts is that they don't come at it from an ideological perspective. I mean, I know it's impossible, but do as much as really is possible. And really, I think it's a very, not only do I disagree with a lot of their extreme ideologies, but I think that's a really bad quality to have in any kind of a judge, even if they might share some of my ideologies. And so how do we redress that without saying, okay, well, if you're going to be a judge, you have to just say this, this, and this. I think that's a really bad precedent in every way.
You know, Mary, I agree with you. I just don't know that I agree with the idea that this is a new phenomenon. I think that judges are political creatures, whether or not that makes us uncomfortable to talk about or whether we think that's impolite. You know, this is sort of the argument that's always swirled around John Roberts. He has this incredible reputation as being, you know, this sort of objective man, but he had an entire career built on partisan conservative politics. So even when he does his respectable judgeship, you know, shtick, he's still acting as a politician. So I think maybe, you know, we should just try to accept that fact and say, we, you know, people who we put on the bench are going to be ideological. And so we have a duty to vet them very strenuously. And that means, for example, not putting someone like Sarah Pitlick on the federal court in Missouri because she's never tried a case, she's never taken a deposition, and she's never directly represented clients in court. You know, that's one way of getting to this issue of these people are unqualified ideologues. Let's just say they're all going to be ideologues and make sure that they're at least at a minimum qualified.
Well, you're certainly the expert, and that makes a lot of sense to me. But I cannot let you go. I know how busy you are, but I'm sure you're like me. You've got one ear and one eye cocked on the impeachment proceedings and somehow trying to focus on what you're doing. Were you able to follow it yesterday and before? And what are you thinking what's happening with the impeachment proceedings going on right now?
I mean, I think I'm glad you're calling them impeachment proceedings and instead of an impeachment trial, because I think that trial has, while I mean, it may be objectively a true word in that sense, I think it has a lot of baggage that we carry with it and expectations. This is going to be a political event. And so I caution listeners to expect objectivity or sort of rules of procedure to work the way that they would expect them to, or that they're used to hearing about them working when it comes in, you know, context of regular trials. You know, that said, I think that there's the whole thing is a circus. And I think that it is a tragedy for the American people that we are in a position where if you want to be engaged in this process, then you are trying to follow impeachment proceedings at 2:00 in the morning on C-SPAN.
And with that, I'm going to cut this short. But again, Jessica Mason Piclo, just always really worth hearing. She's really got a terrific legal mind. And you have been listening to WMNF in Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. I just suggest you keep it tuned here all day, people, because what's gone down is absolutely critical, and it's going to affect all of our lives in every way. And so, Arlene, did you? you want to say? You have a few seconds if you want to say anything.
Oh, I was just going to mention that that Duncan yesterday had a great interview with great Craig Pittman on the Big Cat, the Panther here in Florida, and there are a number of events around that you can attend to get a chance to actually hear Craig in person. It's quite an opportunity. Very few of us, and I'm one of those that has been lucky enough to see a panther actually in the wild, and what a treat. So let's keep them alive.
And again, listen to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Take it easy, people, but take it.
That's just redundant. Chicks got it good now. They can almost be president. But it's worker against worker, time and time again. Cause the rich use certain issues as a tool. When I say we need the ERA, it ain't cause I'm a fool. It's cause without it, nobody can get away with anything.